Welcome to The Wolf Den, the podcast about the business and future of podcasting and digital media. I'm your host, Midroll Media CEO, Adam Sachs. I'm happy to say that my guest today is Guy Raz. Guy is the host of the TED Radio Hour, a radio show and podcast from NPR. The show was named Best New Podcast of 2012 by iTunes. Previously, Guy served as NPR's bureau chief in Berlin and in London, and he has reported from more than 40 countries, including the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the ongoing conflict in Israel and the Palestinian territories. He also spent 2 years as CNN's Jerusalem correspondent. Guy was awarded the Edward R. Murrow Award and the Daniel Shore Journalism Prize for his reporting in Iraq. Before joining the TED Radio Hour, he was the weekend host for All Things Considered. Welcome, Guy Raz. Good to have you, Guy.
Thanks so much. It's great. It's great to be here. I feel like I'm talking to my mishpucha here because I've met you before, of course, yes. Adam, and Jeff Ulrich, who founded Midroll, is a good friend of mine. And Scripps that bought Midroll, Adam Simpson, the chief digital officer. I went to junior high with him. I went to Hebrew school with him. Another one of your executives is Chris Bannon, who was at WNYC and who helped put TED Radio Hour on the air there. And then another Scripps executive is Ellen Weiss, who hired me as an intern at NPR 18 years ago. So I feel like I'm practically, I'm talking to family.
You're part of the family. You absolutely are. That's amazing. Yeah. I think my favorite, Adam Simpson did tell me at one point that you guys went to Hebrew school together here in LA.
Yeah.
And I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah. We went to Hebrew school together. And we were both, me and Adam were both, when we were kids, when we were in like seventh and eighth grade, we were both really into political campaigns. And we both worked for, we both did volunteer work for Republicans, which very right wing Republicans, explains what I'm doing at NPR today. there's a clear path from being a young Republican volunteer to being an NPR correspondent.
So wait, did you guys consider yourselves young Republicans when you were doing that?
Yeah. We were young Republicans, and we used to go door to door, knock on doors. We went to an event when we were in seventh grade. In which Dan Quayle's wife, former Vice President, Marilyn Quayle, appeared at a fundraiser, and we were there and got photos with her, and it was very exciting.
That is exciting. Yeah. Man, you guys were ambitious seventh and eighth graders.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about the TED Radio Hour, of course. You are the host. It is consistently a top 10 show in iTunes. In fact, as of this recording right now, it's number 2. In the podcast charts.
Damn you, cereal.
I know, exactly. I think a lot of listeners would like to know kind of how did the idea for the TED Radio Hour come together? I don't think we need to break down what TED is. I think most people are familiar with TED. But how did the TED Radio Hour come together?
Well, TED came to NPR in 2011, and they said, hey, we would love to collaborate with you on something like a radio show. And NPR was intrigued. NPR had never done a partnership quite like this before, and so they hired a producer and they hired a host to try to put together a pilot series. So the pilot series ran for 10 episodes in the summer of 2012, and it did well. It did very well on iTunes and was a good show, but for a variety of reasons, TED was not happy with the way the show sounded. They weren't happy with the concept of the show. And so they were sort of wondering whether to kind of scrap the whole thing. But they decided that they wanted to give it another chance. And at that time, I was hosting All Things Considered on the weekend. And for a variety of reasons that are probably too long to go into, I was sort of done with the news. I covered the news my whole life, my whole career. And while I love the news, I was sort of tired of covering things with no solutions, to telling stories about the world in which there was just no solution. It was just conflict. It was anger. It was war. It was disputes. And whether it was, U.S. politics or the Middle East, that was the world I was sort of inhabiting. And I was kind of looking for a way to kind of think about the world. I was starting to think about the world in a different way and looking for ways to disseminate that, to tell that story. And So I was asked to get involved, and I got the job. I became the host of the show in the fall of 2012, and the show was not being aired at that point on public radio stations. It was just a summer of 2012 one-off, 10 episodes. We then expanded the staff, and three people from Weekend All who worked with me on Weekend All Things Considered came to the TED Radio Hour, and we basically came up with a completely new way of doing the show. So we were really influenced by, you know, Radiolab, This American Life, and the storytelling and the production that they do. I've been listening to those shows a long time. Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan, and so we started to think about how we could create that feeling. And what there are two things we wanted to do. The first thing is, we wanted to kind of, as best we could, recreate the experience of actually going to TED and sitting in the audience and feeling the connection between the idea, the listener, the speaker, and his or her idea, mm-hmm. and just kind of going through that process of that moment of just enlightenment, you know, sort of this exhilarating moment that happens when you watch somebody talk about an idea that you really are begin to connect with. Mm-hmm. So we want to recreate that as best we could. And the second thing is, for me, the most important thing was that we create a show which was about what it means to be human, because we live in a world now where everybody is really focused on their own identity. And that's fine. That's important. But people kind of forget, you know, when we talk about where we're from or who our parents are or what our religion or faith is, we forget that really at our core we are the same species, right? We are an upright, advanced primate species. We are the only hominin living on planet Earth. We do not share planet Earth with any other human-like species. We did up until 15,000 years ago. We don't anymore. We're the only ones. We are virtually identical as a species. We're born, we die, we grieve. We have the capacity to be jealous, creative, empathetic. We love. We are violent. These are all human traits. Mm-hmm. So the show had to be a show that appealed to somebody living in West Africa and in Hong Kong and in Manhattan and in Seattle and in Buenos Aires. It had to be, it's not a lowest common denominator show, but it had to be a show in which every single one of those people listening could say, wow, that's exactly how I feel, because that's what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. We just did a show a couple weeks ago about anxiety and depression. There is no culture, there's no religion, there's no group of people on the planet Earth that is immune from anxiety and depression. This affects every single culture, everybody on the planet. Not everybody experiences it, but a lot of people do, and probably mm-hmm. most people do at some point, just like all of us at some point catch a cold or get the flu. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to think about the show that way, and that was sort of the genesis of the show. We worked for about 2 months coming up with a bunch of new episodes, and then we relaunched the show as essentially a new show in March of 2013.
And did you have any connection to TED before taking on the show? I mean, even as a fan?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, I had seen TED Talks. I wasn't like a super fan. You know, I sort of, as a journalist, I think I was kind of skeptical of TED Talks. I thought, oh, you know, easy solutions to big problems. And, you know, even initially at the beginning, I was very, very skeptical about whether the show was going to work, whether people were going to believe it or buy into it. And the thing is that it was like a parallel thing was going on as we launched the show. As we saw how many people responded to it, I also began to become really affected by what we were seeing and what we were exposed to. Mm. And we had this incredible experience in that I really understood why this is meaningful, and understood the power of these talks and the power of the people who are giving these talks. I think there's a caricature of what TED is, and it's a it's a really lazy caricature. You know, this idea that it's a sort of this church of high-minded mediocrity or whatever you hear now, you know, time and again. It really has democratized ideas, and it's brought really important ideas and thinking to people all around the world, because thousands of talks are available for free, and they really change people's lives. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't have any connection with TED, but now, of course, I'm very connected with them and feel very much part of the TED family, as well as being part of the NPR family.
And you mentioned that it's not the radio show or the TED Radio Hour is not just an audio recording of the TED Talks that you might see, you know, on YouTube or on stage if you're there in person. You've turned it into a narrative in a way. You really do tell a story, and you do it around a theme. How do you come up with a topic? I guess I could say, how do you come up with these topics?
I mean, there's no real sort of science to it. It's really an art, and we think about it in different ways. So a lot of it, you know, I go to the TED conference. There are a few main TED conferences. There's the main TED conference in Vancouver every year. There is TED Women that happens, and there are some other TED conferences. There's a TED London last year and TED Geneva. And then there are lots of TEDx conferences, mm-hmm. which are self-organized conferences that TED licenses its name but doesn't actually oversee them. I tend to not go to those because I just don't have time. But I go to the main TED conferences, and you know, if there's a talk that just jumps out, I have a whiteboard in my office where I write down the name and then potential themes. And then as I sort of find other talks, it's like building a jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the four or five talks we use in a show may not all obviously go together. We just did a show called The Hero's Journey, in which we have a woman who sailed around the world solo nonstop and broke the world record. We have a former juvenile prisoner who spent 4.5 years in Rikers Island in that show. We have George Takei, who grew up in a Japanese internment camp during World War II. And we had a children's book author in the same episode. Mm-hmm. Right, so really different people, but they're all tied together around one bigger idea. So. And then occasionally it's an idea, you know, I want to do something about anxiety and depression. And that was a show that I really wanted to look at because it's something that I've suffered from and dealt with over the course of my life. And I know a lot of other people have. We're really bad at talking about it. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if we could open up a conversation about anxiety and depression that wasn't depressing, that was actually kind of uplifting, mm-hmm. but gave listeners a sense that, like, you're not alone. We're kind of all in this together. So that's kind of more or less how we start to build the shows.
And I'm curious, like, going beyond that, so it sounds like you tag TED Talks with potential themes that they could be a part of or connected to. And then how much additional research is required for you to prepare, you know, for your interviews and produce the show?
A lot. I mean, only about 25 to 30% of the show is actual talk from the TED stage. And mm-hmm. so sometimes the talk isn't, you know, there are only elements of the talk that will work on the radio because it might be too visual or there's not enough narrative. And in radio and audio, you need narrative. You need storytelling because that's how you connect with your audience. You know, that's how people find these points at which they can kind of grasp on and latch on to the idea or the person who's speaking. So we will spend a lot of time finding out about the person, finding out about what they're doing now, because sometimes the talks are a few years old. I usually try to read some or all of a book the person wrote. Mm-hmm. And then writing questions and writing interview questions takes a long time. You know, usually I write with a producer, you know, we will write a lot of questions and then we kind of toss that aside and the interview is just very organic and natural as we go on because it's you know, you kind of enter a zone. You're like, and I'm exhausted after every interview because it takes so much mental energy that it actually saps your physical energy because you go in and my interviews last about an hour, sometimes an hour and a half. And they're very intense. You know, I'm asking people really personal questions about their lives, and I'm asking them to share that with me and with our listeners. And so you have to make a connection with that person very quickly to do that. And to be able to make that connection, you have to know a lot about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to be ready to kind of find places where you can connect, you know.
And shifting gears a little bit into podcasting specifically, how important is it, do you think, that the TED Radio Hour is available as a podcast? And was it, since the beginning in the fall of 2012, has it been a podcast in addition to being, you know, on the radio?
Yeah. It's always been a podcast and a radio show. I mean, I think we are very lucky that we have both, because the radio side of our show, you know, we are on 620 public radio stations in America, and then we are on FM radio in about 15 countries around the world, including on BBC. So that, even though we don't always back announce to the podcast on the radio, when we do, it does, you know, it does drive traffic. It does drive podcast traffic. I mean, our radio audience in the U.S. is about 1.5 million a week, but our digital audience is about 3.5 million. So we were actually the first NPR show in history in which our digital audience rapidly eclipsed our terrestrial audience.
Do you think that says something about who the fans of TED are?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, we, you know, we have an audience that is generally younger than the sort of the radio, NPR radio audience. And it's an audience that is, I think it's an audience that's kind of open and looking for, I don't know, new kind of just new ways of thinking, you know, mm-hmm. and it's an audience that is looking to kind of looking beyond just the day-to-day news, you know, looking for stories and ideas in which people are really trying to solve problems and trying to create solutions. And I think that there's something really attractive in that. You know, I'm not saying that we are, you know, we have these simple solutions that we offer, because we don't. But the show really is, we are consciously optimistic. I mean, we are, we make no apologies about that. Like, if the news is pessimistic, we are the exact opposite. Like, I'm not going to bring a TED speaker on and, you know, just kind of like try to, you know, shit on their idea. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
We really want to bring it out, and we want to understand what kind of makes them tick. And at the end of the show, we very consciously want to design a show that is going, even a sad show, even a show we did on death, that is going to leave you feeling like there's a possibility, that it's not leaving you feeling despondent. You know, that when you're done with the hour of that episode, you feel powerful. You know, and I think for a lot of journalists, it's lame. You know, a lot of my colleagues at NPR, when I became the host of the show, were very skeptical and kind of, I think, even sort of kind of quietly were snickering about it, because, you know, people just thought TED was kind of bullshit. And I think what happened was that a lot of people were really surprised at how it resonated, how many millions of people the show resonated with and the TED concept resonates with, you know. And it's been incredibly gratifying.
I bet.
We were nervous. You know, I was nervous. I was leaving behind a career in news that I gave my body and soul and sometimes put my life on the line for, to do something that, you know, many of my colleagues in the news division just thought wasn't really worthwhile. And I think what's been really amazing is to see how being positive and kind of putting out positive ideas can really resonate with people. You know, journalists by nature are skeptical and I think sometimes cynical. And what's been really wonderful about being in this world and inhabiting this world is that it's really a world of optimism. You know, TED has done an incredible job at talking about the world in you know, through the spectrum of possibility rather than through the spectrum of impossibility.
Has
and
has
I I think that matters.
Has going from that, you know, that news world of, you know, pessimism to this TED world of optimism and possibility, has it had an impact on your personal life?
Oh, hugely, hugely. I mean, in ways that are just immeasurable. You know, I really, as a correspondent and as a covering, you know, being an overseas correspondent or even being a domestic reporter and host, I saw so many things that really upset me and made me sad. You know, you try, as a reporter, you really try to, you really try to fight against your own biases because we're all born with them, you know. And there were times when I was overseas where I struggled because simply because of who my parents were or my background, people made judgments about me. And not just people I encountered, but even people at NPR. You know, one of my dreams at NPR when I was overseas was to cover I wanted to cover the Middle East. And I did cover the Middle East. I covered Iraq and I covered Saudi Arabia and other countries, Jordan. But Israel-Palestine was just off limits. And the reason why was because of my background, because my parents were Jewish. And not only that, but my parents emigrated to the United States from Israel. Hmm. So at the time, I was just told flat out that I would not cover that story. And it really was a dream to me. And it was a dream to me to try to cover that story in a really fair way. It's a really hard story to cover in a fair way. But ultimately, I left NPR to go to CNN to do that because they gave me the opportunity to do that. So it was an incredible experience, you know, to be able to go overseas and to cover that story and to try and do it with empathy for both sides. And certainly I was accused by Israelis of being biased against them, of being a self-hating Jew. I was accused by Palestinians at times of being a Zionist mouthpiece. But on balance, I think I really was able to do substantive work there for CNN and do it in a way that and do it in a way with empathy for both sides. And I think the way I covered that story was very simple. I went to both communities and I dealt, you know, I sort of approached it with as empathetic as I could. So now I think but the thing is that when I experienced all those things and all that division and all that kind of anger, you know, and then I came back to the U.S. and I covered the end of the Bush administration, and it was just a very difficult time. And then, you know, for the last few years after that, the problems in Congress and all this like vitriol against President Obama and just a really nasty political atmosphere in Washington. I just thought there's something wrong. You know, like I am not making a contribution to the world by pointing this stuff out. And by disseminating it and by giving it a platform, I'm not helping to make the world a better place. And that really, I wanted to change that, you know. So doing this show has, I feel, kind of given me a chance to make that very small contribution. And I have learned, you know, I have learned so much from being exposed to all these ideas, you know, and from being exposed to some of these incredible thinkers who, you know, who are optimists, who really are thinking about how to change the world and how to put ideas out there that create new possibilities.
And do you get feedback from listeners that, you know, that you're helping them or, you know, doing important work?
When I was a news correspondent and when I hosted Weekend All Things Considered, it was very rare if we received positive feedback. Most of the time when listeners write in, it's because they're angry. Mm-hmm. And I understand that impulse. That's a really normal impulse. What's really remarkable about our show is we receive mountains of emails every week, and virtually all of them are positive. And some of them, I cannot believe that people actually, that this is going on in people's lives. But people have emailed letters to us saying that we've changed their lives or that they have made life choices to change because of something they heard on the show. We get tweets, hundreds of tweets every weekend after a show airs from people who are just so moved by what they hear. And I feel like what's incredible is for a show that doesn't deal with the news, I genuinely feel like we're having a bigger impact. Like I am personally able to have a bigger impact on the lives of people listening than I was as a news reporter. And that is something I never anticipated.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is really amazing. It must be so gratifying. I can't let you get out of here without talking about a little bit of the business side. And it's always interesting to me how the business side works in the public radio ecosystem. One thing I think that's, you know, particularly interesting about your show, the TED Radio Hour, is that you actually voice the ads, the host read ad reads.
Yes.
Was that a decision that you made, or that, you know, that NPR made? How did that happen?
Well, it actually goes back to conversations that I had with Jeff Ulrich, your founder, mm-hmm. At Midroll, who is a very good friend and somebody whose advice just really and friendship has been incredible to me. We met, I think, 3 years ago, and he was asking me about our sort of advertising model, and Jeff showed me how we could really drive revenue in a way that would be significant for NPR. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of opened my eyes up, because I've been in the podcasting space for a while. I was the first NPR host to podcast a news magazine. So when I hosted Week in All Things Considered in 2010, we turned that into a weekly podcast, which the other news magazines don't do. So what happened was I started to think about the potential influence, the potential impact we could have at NPR, that if we're a show that costs, you know, $10 a year to make, but we could bring in $50, you know, imagine what NPR could do with that additional revenue, because we are not, you know, we're a mission-oriented public service, non-for-profit organization, and we have mm-hmm. a commitment to serve the public in America, and we have a commitment to cover the news. The news is the core of what we do. But increasingly, if the news is going to be something that is not driven by revenue and profit, which it shouldn't be, then we have to think of it as a public trust. And if it's going to be a public trust, you know, how do we pay for it? Well, one way is by raising money from listeners and from big donors. But another way, and a creative way to do it, is through advertising on the podcast. Now, we don't advertise on the radio. We can't do the same kinds of things because of the FCC regulations. But on the podcast, you know, I was starting to think, what's the big deal if the idea that I had initially was, let's go after advertisers we want to work with only. Mm-hmm. You know, let's see if we can get very specific kinds of advertisers that make things or create things that align with the sound of the show. Now, it hasn't worked exactly that way, but I do think that we've worked with companies that do, in general, do things that do align with the show. So what happened was I went to, at the time, this is about 2 years ago, almost 2 years ago, a group of sort of people at NPR who could make that decision, and I proposed this. I said, look, you know, I think we should start doing this and see if we can really generate more revenue for the show, for NPR. There was a lot of pushback initially. There was really a lot of resistance to this idea, particularly in the news division, because I was seen as a journalist, and they, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of concern that I would be compromising not only my own integrity but NPR's integrity by doing this. Mm-hmm. And I felt that we're living in a different world. You know, our listeners, especially our listeners who are under the age of 35, have lived in a world in which advertising has been all around them, and they're smart enough to understand that advertising pays the bills. And so I pushed for this for a long time. There was a lot of resistance. Finally, in the summer of 2014, we got the green light to do a trial, 3-month trial, and we came up with a bunch of rules. So the rules were, I am allowed to say no. I don't have to read an ad if I don't want to. Mm-hmm. So if there's a company that I'm not comfortable with or language I'm not comfortable with, I don't I don't have to read it. The other thing is we really try to write our own content as much as we can, our own ads as much as we can, to make them sound natural. It's not always possible because some companies want very specific language, but as long as I am not uncomfortable with it, I'm prepared to read it. Mm-hmm. Because those companies are really keeping our show on the air. I mean, they are paying to keep our show on the air, and we're able to make extra money for NPR. So we launched this trial in the fall of 2014, and it has been incredibly successful. You know, it had a huge impact on revenue for the show, for NPR. You know, we are bringing in many times the amount of money that it costs to make the show, which is really important. And I say that only because if the TED Radio Hour can help to produce new programming, new ideas, if it can help TED and NPR's organizations create more, you know, more incredible stuff, that's so important. You know, it's so important for TED. TED is also a nonprofit. You know, TED is also an organization that TED gives away $1 million a year in a prize. They give all their content away for free on the internet. So it costs money to run these organizations, and if we can generate, you know, a significant amount of money from the show, from advertisers that believe in us, to not just pay our bills, but to allow us to create new content, you know, to allow NPR to build new shows about, you know, that deal with race and ethnicity, shows that create and target new audiences, that allows TED to develop new initiatives. It's so important. And I think there was a lot of resistance, and still there is some at NPR, and understandably, right, because we're a news organization. But mm-hmm. I think increasingly people understand that this can be really, if we do it with integrity and we do it in a smart way, because it's not a science, it's an art, and we do have to make judgments, right? But if we could do it in a smart way that doesn't disrupt the message of the show or the feel of the show, and doesn't jar the audience, that's important. To me, what was really, really important was how the audience would react. Mm-hmm. And we did a variety of surveys and audience research in the first 3 months. And what was incredible to all of us was that, to a person, the people interviewed for these audience surveys had no problem with the podcast advertising. Mm-hmm. We have received zero complaints now. We've been doing it for more than 18 months, okay?
That's amazing when you reach millions of people.
We reach 3.5 million people a week. We have received not a single complaint.
That's unbelievable.
In 18 months because of our podcast advertising. And I really think that listeners understand that it's, you know, for us to bring the show to people for free, which we want to continue to do, and to really have time to spend to create this show that we believe in and that we love, and, you know, it has to be paid for, and that is that's the you know, right now, that is the best way to do that. And so it's been a huge success. You know, it's been a really, really big success. And I think you look at Gimlet, you look at what you guys are doing at Midroll, you look at, you know, what's happening on Radiolab. Every, you know, we are all kind of doing different forms of this. Mm-hmm. And it's just been incredibly important, because we in public media, you know, we are going to have to figure out new ways to generate revenue to pay for what we do, because what we do is expensive, right? I mean, creating really high quality audio is expensive, and it requires time and talent and travel and all kinds of things, and we're really able to do it. And it feels incredibly gratifying to work on a show that is like that, you know, where we create a show and people really like it, and advertisers are willing to put their products on it because they know that they're going to reach a really great audience, and that it also makes money for NPR and for TED.
Has NPR, you know, you said that they're getting a little bit more comfortable. Will we see your influence on other shows? Will we see more NPR, you know, podcast hosts voicing their own ads?
I don't know. I mean, I know that some of my colleagues, only some of my colleagues do. Peter Sagal does on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And Ophira Eisenberg does it on Ask Me Another. But we are sort of considered to be non-news hosts. I think there's still some discomfort with having people who are on our news programs do it. And I understand that. You know, I think that probably makes sense. I think as we sort of look forward to where audio is heading and you know, how listener habits are changing and what we will have to do to maintain the quality and integrity of what we do, we're probably going to have to do things that, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, even now, are kind of seen as blasphemous. And the reason why I say that is because if we trust ourselves, okay, if we say, look, we are humans. Humans are fallible. We're not robots. We can't operate like robots. We have to make human judgments. And if we can make considered good judgments, but still do really high quality stuff, then we'll be fine. I mean, you look at Atlantic Media, you look at The New Yorker, they do all kinds of advertising campaigns, and yet nobody questions their integrity because they're fearless, and we should be fearless too. You know, we should be willing as a news organization to do stories about anybody. and I think, you know, I think sort of the underlying fear with all this is, well, what kind of influence will these advertisers have over what you do? And I think it's a legitimate question to ask. But I also think that if we have a really strong, we have strong core values, which we do as an organization, we will be fine.
What can people expect out of you and out of the TED Radio Hour in 2016?
You know, we are we're super excited about the shows we're working on right now, which I can't talk in detail about. But we have a whole slate of shows that, you know, have to do with a variety of human emotions and behaviors. But also we're really thinking more about big themed shows. So we did a show called The Hero's Journey, which we tied in with the release of Star Wars. That show was about Joseph. It sort of began with the story of Joseph Campbell and his blueprint for, called The Hero's Journey. It was the blueprint that he created that explained how all mythology works, this sort of these 17 subsections. And George Lucas followed this to a T in Star Wars. So we kind of told that story at the beginning of the show, and then we used TED speakers to kind of take us along the hero's journey, like stops along the hero's journey. We did a couple shows last year which were really kind of interesting, one called Seven Deadly Sins, one called Maslow's Hierarchy of Human Needs. And I think in 2016 you'll see a lot more shows like that where we kind of think about a big kind of meta topic or a model for the way to kind of structure a part of our universe. And then we kind of explore different parts of that model through TED speakers. And it's just so fun to do it. It's super fun. So, and you know, we're excited that the show is now on in Kenya. It's getting a lot of listeners are really excited about it there.
Wow.
You know, we're getting a lot of listeners in Australia, New Zealand, a lot of people listening through iTunes or through podcasting in Europe. We're on the radio in India and all over East Africa and in parts of Asia and on the BBC and in Ireland. So in Chile, of all places. You know, we're looking forward to a year where hopefully our audience continues to grow and hopefully people really continue to connect with what we do.
Guy, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for being here. So people can find your show on iTunes, I'm sure, the TED Radio Hour. Where else can they find you and your show?
Yeah, they can find us at ted.npr.org, and you can find us on Stitcher, TED Radio Hour, or, you know, any way you get a podcast. Just type in TED Radio Hour, and I hope you like it. I hope it's an hour worth your time. That's what we always say. We have to make it worth your time, so we really try hard to make sure that's the case.
Well, thank you so much for your time. This was certainly an hour, 45 minutes or so worth my time. Everybody, thank you for listening. Subscribe to the show at Earwolf or on iTunes, and please rate and review the show. And until next time, happy podcasting.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's me, Darren Toblerone. You might have heard me and my brother, Aaron Toblerone, on the California Supreme Wind Show, the only podcast all about California Supreme Windows, just minutes from the 405, your number one spot to get great deals on windows, and now also door. But there are many more podcasts than just my brother's podcast. It's true, like with special guest Lauren Lapkus, for example. Every week she plays a different character, and she's the guest of someone else who's playing another character who's the host. It's complicated, but it's also not. But it's also great, almost like a jigsaw puzzle. Listen to this.
Get off your knees, you damn idiot.
Oh, I love you, Regina.
Stand up. I'm going to give you osteoporosis in your knees with my cane. Stand up, you idiot.
I will, master.
Put on this ball gag, you bitch. Take it out. You liked it too much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mommy.
So sit by your favorite window and listen to with special guest Lauren Lapkus on earwolf.com, iTunes, or the podcast player of your choice. Doinky windows forever. Goodbye.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Adam Sachs, and Chris Bannon. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Reza Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.